This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Monty is a triangle-based storytelling organization. In the 8 years since founding the Monty, Jeff Polish has chosen a variety of topics for storytellers. He's asked participants to talk about their experiences around themes of fear, love, humility, much, much more. But one topic that stayed off the list was God. When Jeff Polish eventually decided to broach the difficult subject of a higher power, he did so last year, and the response was off the charts. The Monty hosts another God event on Wednesday, December 14th at Motor Co. Music Hall in Durham, and Jeff Polish joins me on the State of Things. Jeff, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What took you so long to get to God, you know?
God, you know, I just felt that I wanted to keep this organization, you know, away from religion of any kind. I actually feel like there are some dangerous topics out there, like religion's one of them, race is one of them, politics is one of them. And for many years, I was like, let's stay safe. Let's talk about love. Let's talk about fear, like very general things.
With Jeff Polish, you have put people in the most vulnerable positions,
yes.
And their best stories are when they bare their souls and take the biggest risk, and you ran from God.
I know. It's true. Like, on the other side of it, I can't believe it.
That's great. So you did it, and of course, the outpouring was amazing. The response was terrific.
It really was. Yeah. I mean, when people talk about coming to faith or losing faith, and then the events that really catalyze those decisions, that's incredible. And that brings people together. Even if they sit on another side of the point of their perspective, they understand what brought them to those decisions.
And you would have to guess that with your audience and the kind of folks who come to this, it's not going to be a lot of preaching and proselytization, but exactly what you said, these poignant moments in their lives in which religion or God in some way played a big role. So you brought some clips from last year's show, and maybe let's start out with the first one, with a woman who was raised in a sort of Jewish home.
Yeah, very delinquently raised Jew. Who is forced in as an adult to really figure out where God sits in her own life.
Let's listen to Elisa Klein.
My parents were so hands-off that once my mother dropped me off for Hebrew school and sped away, and when I went to go open the door, it was locked. And there was a sign on the wall that said, "Closed for Passover." And when my mother came back 2 hours later to a crying child, no phones, I was sitting there for 2 hours. I mean, she was pissed. She said, "Elisa, how was I supposed to know? It's still Passover." And I was like, "Because we're Jewish." My father wasn't much better. He was fond of vague answers, completely lacking in evidence. He would always give me very wonky answers when it came to the dietary laws especially. So if I challenged him and said, "You know, Jews aren't supposed to eat pork," he'd say, "Right, but you like Chinese food, don't you?" Or especially when it came to lobster, which was aplenty in Rhode Island, I'd say, "You know, I don't think Jews are supposed to eat shellfish." And he'd look at me as if I had the problem. And he'd say, "Right, but we're from Rhode Island." I stayed in New England for college and graduate school, and along the way I met my husband, Seth, a Jewish boy. I think both of us were really surprised to find ourselves as part of a Jewish couple, but I was psyched. I'm like, "Here is our chance. We're going to get this right. Are you with me?" And he was like, "Oh, you don't want to do all that shit, do you?" If I wasn't going to find answers about my religion in my own backyard, I sure as hell wasn't going to find them in Lexington, Kentucky, which is where Seth's academic career took us next. People in Lexington don't identify by what neighborhood they live in. They mostly identified by where they attended church. And from the woman who cleaned your teeth to the mechanic working on your car, everyone wanted to know, "Where do you go to church?" But my religion, growing up, was about bagels and Barbara Streisand. It wasn't about God. Seth's two-year fellowship turned into a faculty position, and so we doubled down and we bought a house, and I became pregnant with our first child, Jonah. And for the first time, I was starting to feel hopeful, and I was psyched. I'm like, "This is going to be the family that we built, and this is going to be special." And it felt really good. And then Benny the electrician tried to save my soul. So Benny was hired to help with the shit show of a house. And I came home one day. He was on the master bedroom. He was supposed to be hanging a ceiling fan. And I came home from work, and I went upstairs, and I just wanted to let him know that I was back and check on his progress. And I said, "Hey, Benny, just wanted to let you know I'm home." And he came down from his ladder, and he said, "Oh, good." He said, "Hey, I wanted to ask you, do you believe Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior?" I was like, "No, Benny, we're Jewish." "We don't. I don't." And he took one step closer, and he kind of got in my face. And he said, "Well, I'm here to tell you Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior." And then he fell on the floor, and he started shaking and twitching and mumbling and speaking in utterances that I couldn't understand. And my mind started racing, and I thought, holy shit, my electrician is having a seizure. And I'm going to need to save his life. And as soon as it started, it ended. And he stood up, and he looked at me, and he said, "Now do you believe?" I mean, and the look on my face, I'm sure, gobsmacked, incredulous. And I said, "No, Benny, I don't." And he looked at me and he said, "Huh, you're a hard sell." And he went back to hanging the ceiling fan. And I went downstairs. And I was shaking with rage and fear. I felt so angry and so violated. And I wanted to go back upstairs and yell at him and scream in his face and tell him, "You don't get to come into my house, the one place that feels sacred to me. And I don't need to go to your church or my temple to know that this is special here. And you don't get to challenge that." That baby I was pregnant with, Jonah, is now 10. That kid has a lot of questions. And my own childhood was so filled of contradictions and unanswered questions, and I was so determined to tell Jonah the right answers. But the only thing I know for sure is that when I'm with Jonah, and I'm with his sister, and I'm with Seth, whether we're in Lexington or Providence or Chapel Hill, I feel the presence of God.
That was a story by Elisa Klein from the Monty's event called God last year. Monty hosts another God event next Wednesday at Motorco in Durham. Founder Jeff Polish is with me here. It's a wonderful story. Did you have to change your approach? Because you do a lot of really marvelous coaching for storytellers. And I wonder if you changed your approach at all.
I didn't change my approach too much. I mean, I have a process that I developed. And I mean, it's pretty standard and it's very immersive. With that particular story with Elisa, I was very concerned about how she's going to come across. I mean, she's Jewish, and she's in Lexington, Kentucky, and she is, in a sense, rejecting, you know, the other religions that are, you know, posing themselves in front of her. And I didn't want her to come across as being overly judgmental. Rather, that's just not something that appeals to her, and in that case with Benny the electrician, that she felt a certain level of violation. But I didn't want the judgment to come across, and whether or not it did or didn't, well, that's up for the viewer or the listener to decide.
No, but it's an interesting question in a way, and one of the other things that happens through your process is that the storyteller begins to examine a story that they may have been telling for years in a new way, and it is for them a profound insight. So more than just warning them off a certain thing, you might bring them to a deeper level. And I wonder if that happened at Elisa's level of story or others, where people who thought they knew the moral of their story, if I may simplify, found an even deeper meaning in their own story.
It happens all the time where you're right, where people have been telling a story for years and then they come to me and I'm like, well, I think you're selling a different message than you think you're selling. And we need to examine that and look at that. And if that is real, then we need to smooth it out, because people are either going to engage or disengage with your story if you're selling a different point.
Let's hear part of another one now. Your show about God included one person's real questioning of God, especially in a period of crisis and pain. Let's listen to a part of Mandy Hitchcock's story.
People say miracles happen every day. I watched a dramatic story unfold on Facebook this summer when a friend of mine began sharing the posts of a father of a young teenage boy who had suffered a brain injury. The father found his son in bed one morning, unresponsive, and rushed him to the hospital. The boy wasn't supposed to live, but they decided to move him to an intensive care unit to keep him alive long enough that his family could gather around him and see him. The father took to Facebook immediately, asking for people's prayers for his son. And he said that he and his wife had accepted the possibility of their son's death, and they had accepted whatever God's will was going to be in this situation, but that they were still going to petition God to intervene and heal their son's body completely. He accepted friend requests from hundreds of people, and these people littered his Facebook wall with all kinds of prayers for his family and his son. 6 days after this father found his son unresponsive in the bed, this boy woke up from his coma and started speaking. And the medical staff had no explanation for this sudden recovery at all. But the father and all of these people who had gathered around this family believed that a miracle had occurred. They believed that they had prayed and God had answered their prayers and intervened and healed this boy. And I watched all this unfold over several days with this feeling of an elephant stepping on my chest, because the story was so familiar to me. Because a little over 5.5 years ago, my family endured a very similar scenario. In May of that year, 2010, on Mother's Day, my 17-month-old daughter, Hudson, woke up with a fever, and I was worried. And I called the pediatrician that Sunday afternoon, and then I took her into the pediatrician's office the next morning, and both times I was reassured that it was a typical virus and that it was going to run its course and that we didn't have anything to worry about. A little later that day, though, the pediatrician sent us into the emergency room to get some IV fluids because Hudson still hadn't been eating or drinking for a while, and we were concerned that she was going to become dehydrated. While I sat in the emergency room, I was posting from my phone on Facebook that we were in the emergency room for the first time. My friends started posting and texting and saying that they hoped everything was okay. And then a few hours after that, I posted that she had actually been diagnosed with bacterial meningitis. And at that point, both the tenor and the volume of the messages that we began to receive changed significantly, because bacterial meningitis is a terrifying disease. That next night, she began showing signs of a brain injury. They put her into a coma. And not long after that, not one, but both of her pupils stopped responding to light. And when the hospital social worker came and took us into a private room, I knew that we were about to get news that was going to change our lives forever. The doctor told us that she had suffered a massive brain injury, and that if she survived, that she would likely never walk again or talk again or ever be the same child that we had known just 24 hours before this. My next post on Facebook said that Hudson's condition was very critical and that I had debated about posting on Facebook at all about it, but that the support had been so welcome and that if miracles really happened, then we could all be hoping for one. And the next time that I posted on Facebook, I said that her prognosis was very grim and that we were really in miracle territory now. That night, Wednesday, they did the first of two tests for brain death, and it showed that her brain was no longer functioning at all. And they repeated that test 24 hours later, and it confirmed the results of the first test, and she was declared dead. And we said goodbye to our daughter in the hospital, and we went down to the parking garage, and we climbed into our car, and we drove home without our little girl. So when I heard the news of this boy's seemingly miraculous recovery, I was struck by how similar these stories were and how incredibly differently they turned out. And while I was so grateful and relieved that that family's child had recovered, I was incredibly jealous that my child had not. And all I could think when I read all those posts was, if God is so amazing and if his handiwork is so awesome, then why is my child dead? She had thousands of people praying for her all over the world, too.
It's a story by Mandy Hitchcock from the Monty's event called God. It was last year. The Monty's hosting another God event Wednesday at Motor Co. in Durham. Founder Jeff Polish is here with me on the state of things. Jeff, that's very much a story, it seems to me, and I think the power of your event, a story that's still in process. That's a story that'll be told differently every time.
Absolutely, which is an incredible thing to consider. Imagine how that story would be told in 5 years, in 10 years. I mean, where is she going to be? Clearly, she will never fully, you know, recover from this loss. But how will she process, you know, her faith or lack thereof? Will it be the same? And that's what stories are. They're perspectives in the moment. How do you feel about these events?
How did you feel about these events? I wonder, again, this is a story that for very good reasons, you had good reason to be a little bit cautious about entering this, having one under your belt or at least a series. Did it change? Did it make you think more deeply about these subjects?
Oh, definitely. I mean, first off, with the response to our previous God show, how many people were interested in attending it, how people were dying to come to this show. And then we delivered, and it was an amazing event. I mean, if I may say so, it really did deliver. It really emboldened me, empowered me to tackle more topical things, like I said I didn't want to do in the past, like race, politics, things like that. Except I don't love debating anything. Yeah. I love taking those points that would normally be thrown out in a debate and embed them into narrative with action, with perspective. And when a listener hears those things, they're somewhat irrefutable. Not that the listener is going to agree with the storyteller, but they'll connect with the action and the storyteller, and it'll bring them closer, and then the discourse raises to a different place. It's less aggressive, less adversarial, and that's the way that I like to express
myself. Well, and there is an irreducible truth about the story in that it is the subject's view of things.
Yes.
So from a subjective point of view, this is precisely how I feel about it, and that makes that truth irrefutable, whether objectively you want to accept it.
And then they're also telling you why they feel that way, and that becomes very powerful.
Powerful stuff, as always, and Jeff, a pleasure to have you back on the show. Jeff Polish, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff Polish is the founder of The Monty. It is a storytelling organization, and it hosts the second round of Stories About God next Wednesday, 7:30, Motor Cove Music Hall in Durham. We have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, what does it mean to be brown in post-9/11 America? We'll talk about that with scholar Kumarini Silva on the State of Things. Please stay with us.